I'm speaking today with J.C. Chong. J.C. is a professor, an extension specialist, an entomologist, and he is stationed at the PD Rec over in Florence. J.C., thanks for coming today. And there's a lot of concern among the public about the neonicotinoids. And so I think the best thing we can do is try to give them scientific research. And so we appreciate your sharing your knowledge with us today.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Okay. First of all, what are neonicotinoids and kind of what's their history? What was before them? Just what are they?
Right. So neonicotinoid is a class of insecticide that is probably one of the workhorse of our industry, of our agriculture. We have used it quite a bit, actually. So the neonicotinoid itself, if you break it apart, the word itself, neo means new, and nicotinoid is synthetic nicotine. So it's actually a class of compound working in very similar way as nicotine, which is the active ingredient in tobacco. Nicotine has been used for thousands of years for controlling insects, but nicotine has a very nasty property, which is that they have very, very high toxicity to mammals.
Uh-huh.
So the neonicotinoid, the whole reason why they were basically developed and created was really to replace nicotine and also organophosphate as a safer, more selective insecticide.
So the animal world overall is greatly less impacted with neonicotinoids than the old nicotine-based pesticides.
Correct, correct. But so the toxicity of neonicotinoid to a mammal is several hundred times safer than the nicotine.
But it's effective on insects, and there was a tragic situation when a pesticide applicator did not do what you pesticide specialists always tell us to do, which is?
Well, we always say read the label. Label is the law.
Yeah.
So you need to be reading the label, just not only because it's the law, but also because that is a safe way to actually use the product itself. So if you did not follow the law and ended up hurting somebody or something, and that could be very tragic, and it could cause your business a lot of trouble as well.
Well, and also it tells you what you need to do as far as protective equipment to keep yourself safe when
Absolutely. And, you know, every insecticide, it doesn't matter how safe they are, they are still some sort of chemical, and there may be some unintended consequences. And therefore, you need to do everything you can to protect yourself. And that's the personal protective equipment requirement on the pesticide label is pretty important, because that's one thing that you could do to really making yourself safer.
J.C., tell us about the event that brought this to the public's consciousness when the pesticide applicator made the tragic application he did.
Sure. And, you know, the whole controversy of neonicotinoid with pollinators, it has been going on for some time, but it really come to a boil in 2013. In June 2013, there was one landscape operator in Oregon that made an application to a flowering lindan tree. And within hours, there are thousands of bumblebees dropping dead right around the trees on the parking lot, and it's causing a huge uproar. And since then, there was a lot of calls to actually cancel or even limit the use of neonicotinoid because of their impact on pollinators.
The industry that grows flowers, annuals and herbaceous perennials, and sells them every spring and fall to consumers is a big industry, and I think they reached out to you and other people to do some studies to find out if their products were endangering bees. And describe how y'all went about that, please, JC, and what the results, y'all's findings were.
Sure. And we actually conducted a series of studies, basically. We're funding from a USDA, Specialty Crop Research Initiative, and also some trade organizations as well. For example, American Flora Endowment, and also Horticultural Research Institute. Mm-hmm. And all of these agencies, these sponsors actually provide us with research funding. Really, what we and the sponsors trying to find out is, okay, let's find out what is the impact of neonicotinoid applied to ornamental plants on pollinators. And let's figure out what is the impact and try to figure out a way to really minimize that risk so that we don't have to end up suffering the consequences in Oregon once again. So there's quite a few studies within this particular one. There are two major studies. One of them is to look at when you apply a neonicotinoid insecticide and several other systemic insecticides to the ornamental plants, and what would happen, how much of that active ingredients actually ended up in the nectars and pollen.
I see.
Because, you know, the pollinators would just feed on the nectars and the babies feed on the pollen, right? So you need to know how much of that are in the nectars and pollen and how that is going to impact the pollinators and also the colony health.
And did you also study it as a period of time after application sometimes?
Correct. So what we're looking at are not just neonicotinoid, but some of the newer systemic insecticide as well. Just to look at, you know, we know neonicotinoid might have some issues, but what about the other ones? So we try to cast a pretty wide net to try to do that. And we also look at different application rate, the high label rate and the low label rate. And we also look at whether there is a difference if you spray them or when you drench them.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So
these products can be taken up by the plant and
correct.
Moved. They are systemic. Correct. They can be systemic. Is that
right?
Correct?
So what's happening is that if you spray it and it landed on the leaf surface itself, the compound can actually penetrate the leaf tissue and go into the conductive tissue inside the plant, the phloem, and ended up taking it to the rest of the plant. Or if you drench it, the root is going to soak up all that insecticide and then bring it up through the entire plant that way. So both application method may have impact and how that's going to influence the amount of residue.
And then you also sat out there and watched to see.
We did. So
okay,
another major project in major experiment in this project. Yeah. Is to try to figure out, well, which of these ornamental plants are actually attractive to the pollinators. Because if you go online, you can find within 5 minutes, 5, 10, 15 different lists of bee-friendly ornamental plants. Are they really bee-friendly? Is it just based on observation, or was it some kind of data behind it? And what we try to do is really put the data behind that attractiveness. And one other point about this particular study is that we don't just pick any plants willy-nilly. And what we do is that we go to USDA Agriculture Survey and pick some of the top species of plant that were the most widely produced in the United States. Because if they are most widely produced, meaning that there are more people going to buy them.
Yes.
There will be more people sticking in the ground. So what we try to figure out really is two things. One thing is, how many of them are actually pollinator attractive? So the one they are attractive, we could make recommendation and say, hey, if you are growing a bee-friendly or pollinator-attractive garden, these are the plants that you can grow. And another thing would be to really help with EPA in their registration process to tell them, all right, not every plant species, not 100% of the plant species that we produce are impacted by these applications. You should probably look at 50%, 25%, or however many percent that is attractive to pollinators and focus on those instead of looking at 100%.
And you looked, when you made your counts of how attractive they were, you also didn't just look at, say, bees or pollinators in general. You broke it down and classified that as well. So it was Correct. A very in-depth study.
It's a very in-depth study, and it's not just conducted in South Carolina. We conduct the same experiment in California, Connecticut, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and of course in South Carolina as well. And each garden basically grow anywhere from 5 to 6 different species. Within each species, we have 5 to 6 different cultivars. So it's a pretty wide net. And what we do is basically sit out there and do something that entomologists love to do, which is look at bugs, right? Sit out there, stare at the plants for 5 minutes, for 10 minutes, just to see how many of these pollinators come and visit the flowers. And we write them down. We don't just say butterflies or bumblebees. We say very specifically, is that a bumblebee? Is that a honeybee? Is that a sweat bee? Or is that a minor bee? So we actually do a much more fine details identification than what typically say, you know, pollinator friendly.
Yeah. Well, I think in this case, JC, your results would give someone who was concerned about that some reassurance about bringing home plants that had been grown specifically for people to add to their gardens, and that the results were kind of surprising in that there was a kind of a small subgroup that really was attractive to the pollinators.
Right. So the way we look at that is we define the attractiveness of pollinators by how many pollinators actually was attracted within a 5 minutes period. And we kind of classified it as low, medium, and high in some way, somewhat attractive or not attractive and highly attractive. And what we are finding is that of all the plant species that we produce in this country, less than 10% of what we produce can be considered pollinator attractive. And the rest of the 90%, they attract very, very few pollinators, if any at all.
Do you think that 10% has now produced with some different methods sometime, or are they just not produced so often? What effect did you think the information you were able to come up with might have had on what is being shipped to the stores?
So what we're trying to find out, so I think the way our result can be used is to inform the growers, what can you do to the plant, right? So if you are growing a plant that is highly attractive to pollinators, then you probably do not want to use any insecticide that can be detrimental.
All right.
To pollinators. And that would include neonicotinoid, and that would also include organophosphate and pyrethroid. But if you are growing the other 90% of the plant, you probably would have a little bit more freedom as far as what you could use. Okay. And basically, it basically comes down to cost and benefit, risk and benefit analysis in some way. And you would say, okay, it's a high-risk plant, I'm not going to use this. It's a low-risk plant, maybe I could use that. So what we try to do is really develop the kind of information that the growers can use to actually make a pest management decision.
And JC, this product, although it does have its own set of concerns that we have to be cautious and aware of and try to minimize whenever possible, as you said, it certainly is an improvement over the straight nicotine-based products and the organophosphates. Is that correct?
Correct.
As far as safety?
Correct.
Okay.
So the organophosphate, a little bit of history here, I guess. So organophosphate, a lot of organophosphate are actually developed right after the First and the Second World War. They were actually first developed as poison, nerve gas.
Oh, my goodness.
For warfare. And some of them, we actually use them for controlling pests. So if you look at that history, you're going to know some of these organophosphate actually have very, very high toxicity because it is really used to kill people. And now they were using it to kill bugs.
All right. JC, I want to thank you for this information. And I hope that we can come back to you and do another talk with you about the other parts of the industry that it's used in, and that would be in field crops and in turf management as well. And I think that would be a good topic for another chat if you think you might be able to take the time.
I look forward to that.
Thank you so much, JC.
Thank you, man.